I'm standing outside facing two perfectly polished black granite walls, and I'm looking at a sea of names. Each one is a person who served and died in the Vietnam War. You may have been here yourself. If not, you've probably seen pictures of this place. It's the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. The walls appear to be cut into the earth. They're 10 feet at their deepest where they join in a wide open V, and each one gently tapers out to a point. You can't hear the traffic here much, just the sound of an occasional plane flying overhead. The dead are listed here according to when they died, but they're arranged so that when you stand in the middle where the walls meet, that's where I'm standing now, you can take in the name of the first person to die and the last person to die at once. There's Dale R. Boyce, who died in 1959, and Richard Vandegeer in 1975. Their names are the bookends for 58,316 others listed on the memorial. That was by design, of course. This was all by design. The quiet, the simplicity, the names unadorned and displayed like a book. Maya Lin was 21 when her design was chosen. It was a blind competition, so the judges had no idea they were picking the work of a college student, and an Asian American college student at that, both of which became factors in the firestorm of controversy surrounding the design. If you weren't alive or old enough in 1981 to be aware, my God, even if you were, it's hard to conceive of what went on over this memorial, because there's certainly no controversy now. This place is almost sacred, and it's drenched with the tears of the 5 million plus visitors who come each year. Maya Lin has continued to create memorials and buildings and incredible works of art ever since. Her story and her truly original views about art and architecture and remembrance are the subject of today's episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
I think you have to be forever questioning what you're up to. I think you have to both have conviction and be sure, and at times completely question everything and anything you do. I think you have to understand that no matter how much you study, no matter how much you know, it's funny, it's like it's almost like the side of your brain that has sort of the smarts won't help you in making art necessarily. Now that's a frightening notion, that nothing you might learn will help you in being creative. In fact, it's just, at times it could hurt you if you think too hard. Sometimes you have to stop thinking.
That's Maya Lin. She actually thinks a lot about art when she's not in the middle of creating it. We're going to get to the remarkable story behind her most famous work in a few minutes, but she's now spent decades working as an artist, and she talked about all of it, as well as her path to a creative life, during interviews with the Academy of Achievement in 2000 and in 2017. So we're going to go back now to the beginning, to the origins of Maya Lin's art, which she attributes largely to her parents. They were both Chinese immigrants, her father a ceramicist who became Dean of Fine Arts at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, and her mother a poet, who also taught at Ohio U.
It's funny, as you live through something, you're not aware of it. It's only in hindsight that you realize what indeed your childhood was really like. Growing up, I thought I was white. didn't occur to me that I wasn't white. I'm very Midwestern in a lot of my affectations, what I like to eat. Probably didn't occur to me I was Asian American until I was studying abroad in Denmark, actually. And there was a little bit of prejudice, racial discrimination, because as I get a suntan, I look like a Greenlander. And as the U.S. had a certain prejudice against Native Americans, the Danes had a similar read towards the Greenlanders. And all of a sudden, they would be moving away from me in the bus. They wouldn't sit next to me. There would be these weird comments. And growing up, I think I was very, I would say, naive. Our home life was very, very close-knit. It was my mother, my father, my brother, and I. I never knew my grandparents on either side. When I was very little, we would get letters, and they'd be censored from China in Chinese. And so we were a very insular little family. We stayed very close to home. I think that's Chinese. I loved school. I studied like crazy. I was a class A number one nerd. And when I wasn't in school studying, I was taking a lot of independent courses at the university. And if I wasn't doing that, I was casting bronzes in the school foundry. So I was basically using the university as a playground, probably because I didn't fit in high school at all. I have probably fundamentally antisocial tendencies. I mean, let's face it, I never took one extracurricular activity. I just failed utterly at that level. And so there was a part of me that was like, oh, how many days do I have before I can get out of this town? So I think creativity and my artistic drive emanates from that childhood in a way. I didn't have anyone to play with, so I made up my own world.
Because of her father's position at the university, she had all the tools she needed, she told journalist Mary Jordan in this 2017 interview, right at her fingertips.
So my brother and I would get off after school every day, walk across the playground to the fine arts department, and I'd be sitting there making clay things my whole, like, from first grade to fifth grade. I don't think there was a minute that I wasn't making something. And by the time I was in high school, I was casting bronzes at the foundry at the university and meeting these incredible artists who had come through, George Siegel, Michael Singer. It was just kind of a treat. It was like this rarefied little world that allowed me to be as creative as I wanted to be.
Do you remember the first time when you were very young and you made something and you thought, wow, I can do this?
No, actually, it was the other way around. My brother and I were pretty competitive with one another. He's a poet now, a language poet. And since I was 2.5 years younger, he'd always like, let's make this. And then he would make something and it would look really great. And I would make something and it would be like someone 2.5 years younger. And it would be sort of blobby. I still carry this little wallaby I made. He made this perfect precision sheep and every single little clay dot was, you know, it was perfect, and there was my kind of malformed little wallaby. I must have been like 7, and it didn't even occur to me that I was good at what I would become.
Why do you keep that blob that you made when you were 7?
Oh, it's not a blob, it's a little wallaby. You know, you keep these things, you keep what you made. It's like I have these like silver little animals that I made that I cast in high school. It's like you give them to the kids in the end. It's, you know, my parents fled China. They brought almost nothing with them. And, you know, when you come from a situation where your family has fled China, they met in the States with absolutely no past. I think my mother had $20 sewn into her coat to come out to go to a scholarship at Smith. And they never talked about their past when we were growing up. That you surround yourself with what your childhood was and you give that to your kids. You share all that past with them because it's really important.
Maya Lin has plenty now to leave her children.
There are the personal pieces of memorabilia, but also the legacy of her contributions to art and architecture throughout the United States, the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, the Women's Table at Yale University, the Africa Center in New York, the Wave Field in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the Confluence Project in Washington State and Oregon. The list goes on. If you only know about Maya Lin's very first public work, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, go online and explore her other pieces, whether monuments, buildings, or sculptures. She says she approaches each one as an artist.
I'm much more of an artist who happens to build buildings. It's been a fun process of learning, and I think with art, there are times when you make things and you know you've hit it and it's perfect pitch. But the thing about being an artist is the minute you've made an artwork, you're an artist. The minute before, you're full of doubt, will I ever make that work of art? The minute after, will I ever make another work of art? There is no guarantee in creativity, in the arts, that what you bring to it will make it into a good work of art. And I think one of the reasons I was very attracted as I went through undergrad and then graduate school, and I was trained in architecture, but it was the art that was drawing me, because no matter how hard you work at something, it doesn't necessarily make it a good work of art.
How can you inspire the creativity side?
It inspires you. I don't think, and I do believe for me, I didn't have a choice. From day one, I was making things. And I think people have been drawing in the caves, leaving a historic legacy through the creative field. It makes us human. I think art is one of our languages. If all of us have that extra tool, that extra language, it's going to get us to think outside of the box. It's going to get us to think of literally how we problem solve at times, that creativity is something that pervades every aspect of the way humans, the way we think.
What do you mean you didn't have a choice?
I just always wanted to make things. It's literally, it's not like I woke up one day and said, I'm going to be an artist. In fact, I think if you'd asked my English teachers, they would have thought I would be a writer, and the math teacher, I was really strong in math and science, but I never stopped making things.
Maya Lin was a self-described teacher's pet, good at every subject except gym, where she was always picked last on account of her size. She read like a fiend, and she especially loved math and chemistry, where she had a fondness for blowing things up. She also learned everything she could about the natural world.
I thought I was going to become a veterinarian. I loved animals growing up. Then I sort of switched into, in high school, I was definitely going to become a field zoologist because I loved animals and I loved the environment. And none of us connected, even though art was what I did every day, it didn't even occur to me that I would be an artist. Then I get to Yale, and my advisor is a science advisor because I've specified my interest is field zoology in animal behavior. And it was Dr. Apfel, who I still talk to every now and again, and he goes, well, Yale's animal behavior program is probably not what you're going to approve of. And I said, well, why? He said, it's neurologically based, and it dealt with vivisection. And I didn't even know what vivisection was, but it basically means dissecting the animals while they're still alive. And I looked at him and I said, you're absolutely right. Ethically, there's no way. And so though I was actually tracked pre-med at that time, I thought of, oh, this isn't going to work. And then I thought of architecture because I thought it was this perfect combination of art and math, art and science. And I loved logic, math, computer programming. I loved systems and logic approaches. And so I just figured architecture is this perfect combination. Then it takes me 7 years of architecture school to realize that I think like an artist. And even though I build buildings and I pursue my architecture, I pursue it as an artist? And basically, what does that mean? It's much more individual. It's much more about who you are and what you need to make, what you need to say for you. Whether someone's going to look at it or not, you're still going to do it.
When Maya Lin got to Yale and settled into architecture, she became obsessive at times, working late into the night on her projects, forgoing the library entirely. But she had no ambitions to design monuments.
I didn't. That, again, was serendipitous. You know, I did something unusual my junior year in college. Again, moment of inspiration. My dad had a show up of Scandinavian architecture. I go home for the holidays. I sit in, I'll never forget it. It was the Jakobsen egg chair. I'm sitting in this chair. It's unbelievably comfortable and beautiful. And I go, I have to go to Denmark to study architecture. I go to Yale and nobody goes away for junior term. And they're like, well, if it's taught here, you can't, you have to prove that what you're going to learn isn't taught here. And I said, Danish. So I had found this architecture program. I went abroad, and I was given a part of Copenhagen that happened to have the largest cemetery, Assisten Cemetery, I think, in Copenhagen. And it was a beautiful park. It was as beautiful or more beautiful than Central Park, because in Europe, space is tight. So people use their cemeteries as living parks. And it got me thinking that, you know, America's kind of funny. We hide away our elderly. We don't want to look at dying or aging. You know, we're kind of afraid of it. We're a very youth-oriented culture. And other older cultures, it's really a part of life, and you embrace it, and it becomes, you're not afraid of it, and it's part of the cycle. And you go back to more indigenous tribes and how they deal with it. The mourning rituals are unbelievable. Or you go back into, like, you know, my Chinese heritage. You live with your grandparents. You live with your elderly. They're really apart. And it just got me thinking quietly.
When Maya Lin returned from Denmark and went back to Yale for her senior year, she and a group of other architecture students approached a professor with the idea for a seminar, The Architecture of Death. They would study how our ideas about mortality get expressed in the structures we build for the dead.
And in the course of that semester, someone saw a bulletin for a competition for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and we thought, what a great idea. We'll use that as our final project. So I designed what I thought was the right solution for a course. And we had barely been given any information. Someone wrote away for the program book later on and read through it. And I'm realizing I should enter this because I think it's an important thing to say. It's not going to win. And I entered it.
And just what was the important thing that Maya Lin, at 21, wanted to say with her design?
It was about how in war, we often forget the individual. And that for me, especially with that war, it had been so politically divisive. Could we make a project? Could I make something that would rise above the politics, focus on the individual? So in the end, and I think this is what is a trademark of my entire body of work, I will make a work, no matter how public it is, I will still always make it thinking of that one-on-one relationship, how one individual is going to relate to that work. And a lot of these works are very personal, they're very intimate, they relate to you at a very psychological level. So for instance, with the Vietnam Memorial, the names are half an inch high. So you're not going to read this as a public monument, you're going to read it as a book. How do you read a book? One-on-one. It's a very private experience. The fact that it's a timeline that begins and ends at the apex, beginning and end of the war meet, broken by the earth, and that literally any returning veteran finds their time. So when they go to find a colleague, they'll find within a few panels everyone they knew, because this was an 18-month cycle for most veterans that would come in. And they were cycled in, not, you know, they would come in, they would leave on their own time frame. So time becomes a very, very important part of how this war was fought in a way, and by being able to bring a veteran back to their time is going to make each veteran remember their time. And that's how it connects to you. Now, if you're someone who doesn't know anyone, then it's a much more psychological feeling. As you walk down, it only goes down 10 feet. It walks down enough so that the sounds of the city disappear, but you actually feel like you're not so much walking down as the names are rising up. And then you see yourself reflected in those names. And that becomes almost like Orpheus descending. There's a world of the dead. There's a world beyond which the living cannot reach. And then we have to turn around and walk back into the light.
Here's how President Barack Obama talked about Maya Lin's work when he awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2016.
The project that Maya Lin designed for her college class earned her a B+ and a permanent place in American history. So, all of you B+ students out there, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial has changed the way we think about monuments, but also about how we think about sacrifice and patriotism and ourselves. Maya has given us more than just places for remembering. She has created places for us to make new memories. Her sculptures, chapels, homes are physical acts of poetry, each reminding us that the most important element in art or architecture is human emotion.
When Maya Lin came up with her design, she didn't know that the veterans involved had asked for the memorial to include the name of every American who died in the war. In hindsight, she says their request was remarkable because throughout history, war memorials had always been built by the leaders of the winning side as political statements, with little regard for the foot soldiers. When she submitted her design to the competition, Lin attached an essay to her drawings, explaining her thinking, and that essay helped clinch the deal, because after all, the design was radically simple and a complete departure from memorials that had come before. Maya Lin told Irv Drasnin, who conducted the interview for the Academy of Achievement in 2000, that thinking and writing have been a crucial part of many of her projects ever since.
And what I want to do is try to understand what I want to do as an idea. I try to think of a work as an idea without a shape. If I find the shape too soon, especially for the memorials, which have a function, then I might be predetermining a form and then stuffing the function into the form. Instead, what I try to do is for 2 to 3 months read, research, understand anything about the site. And I don't just mean the physical site. I mean the cultural site, the historical site, who's coming, what the needs are, what I think needs to be done. The most important thing I thought was the acknowledgement of a loss. We have to face it. If we can't face death, then we'll never overcome it. So as opposed to pretending it never happened, you have to look it straight in the eye. Then you can turn around and walk back out into the light. So I wanted something that would be honest about the war, not say anything political. Now, I deliberately did not read anything about the Vietnam War because I made a judgment, which is very different from civil rights, because I read everything I could on the civil rights era. With the Vietnam War, I really felt the politics of the war eclipsed what happened to the veterans, that the politics were irrelevant to what this memorial was, that I had to make an apolitical statement. I needed to, because there were people on that wall who were for it, there were people on that wall who were against it. I wanted to offend neither of them. That was a huge goal. So I deliberately did not want to know anything about the politics behind the war.
And here's this 2 to 3 month verbal process. Then I visit the site. Boom, put all that science, analytic, away and allow the art side to come out. And yes, then I just lay an egg is the joke. Why an egg? Because an egg is an idea comes out fairly fully formed. I don't work it and work it and work it. The idea is there. It happens overnight sometimes. It happens when I'm at a site sometimes. I know it right away, and I knew it when I saw the site. I wanted to cut it open and open up the earth and polish the earth's edges. Then came the embellishment of the names having to be chronological, which had to be key. And it turns out time plays out in a lot of my works. That, in a nutshell, is that design.
On the last day of classes her senior year, Maya Lin's roommate came to tell her that the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund had called with some questions. But the questions required officers of the fund to fly in to visit her in her dorm room at Yale.
Can you just tell us about the moment that you're in the dorm and three people come in?
My roommate was there, Liz Perry. Colonel Shate was talking, and he goes on and on, largest competition ever held. And without missing a beat, he says, and you won. And then he kept on going. And I just stared at him because two things were happening in my mind. One, I had studied Washington memorials. And there's a famous one that I think it was designed by Robert Venturi and Richard Serra, L'Enfant Plaza. And they started with this three-dimensional mapping of L'Enfant Plaza, and Richard Serra had done these two artworks. By the time they got through with them, it was one flat map, no Richard Serra. Things don't get built as they're designed in Washington. If you look at the FDR, how many years of debate, and look at the Washington Monument. Why do you think there's a color change? Because at a certain point, everyone was screaming, why isn't there a statue of Washington? They start throwing the stones in the tidal basin. I think it's the time of the Civil War, things stop, and by the time they get going again, the stone has changed color. So there's a line. So if you study anything about Washington, it's hard to get memorials built in Washington. And so I kind of spent my year in D.C. with this idea that I'm going to fight really hard for it, but it's probably not going to get built. This is just the way I've lived my life. I like to expect kind of the worst case scenario, and then I'm not disappointed. And I think the veterans were a bit like, well, why aren't you celebrating? And it's like, I knew that I was going to have a battle and a half in front of me.
Her gut was spot on. Celebrating was premature.
The very first press conference, some reporter asks, do you think it's ironic that this is a memorial to the Vietnam War and you're of Asian descent? Now, I'm born and raised in Athens, Ohio. I had never been exposed to, in our country, to racism. You know, university town. So what mattered was what you thought. That's all that mattered. What you looked like, your age, your race, your sex, didn't matter. And so I looked at this report and I said, well, that's irrelevant. And I'm sure everybody else was thinking, we have some issues. And I don't know if it was my age, my race, or my sex. But, and, you know, the veterans were very protective. I didn't realize how bad the prejudices were. The hate mail, the letters, they buffered me from that.
There were the personal insults, the racial slurs, and then there were the attacks on the design itself. As hard as Maya Lin had tried to be apolitical in her approach to the war and the memorial, politics has a way of asserting itself, and Washington cannot help being Washington. In short, all hell broke loose.
I had studied how competitions are handled in Washington. And basically, for the most part, things never get built the way they were drawn. It is a small miracle that the memorial looks exactly the way it was
designed. You have to go through 5 governmental agencies 2 times for review. That's normally where architectural projects, art projects, get extremely modified, to put it kindly. And I get in there, and everyone was so nice within these 5 legal, correct channels. In fact, technically, if you look at it, there should have been no problem. The controversy was completely extra. It was like this weird baggage that was thrown in because Reagan, Secretary of the Interior Watt, H. Russ Perot, all kind of got together and decided the design wasn't right.
A little background here. Ross Perot, who would later run for president, was a Texas billionaire. When a wounded vet named Jan Scruggs created the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund to campaign Congress for a spot on the National Mall and to raise private money to pay for it, Ross Perot donated a fair chunk of change. But when Perot saw the design that the professional jury had selected and he found out who had designed it, he was aghast and told Jan Scruggs, "You've made a big, big mistake." He then began a campaign to block the memorial as designed. He even hired Roy Cohn, the attorney best known as aide to Senator Joseph McCarthy, and they accused the fund of misusing its money. 27 Republican congressmen joined the campaign to denounce Maya Lin's design. They wrote to President Reagan, quote, "We feel this design makes a political statement of shame and dishonor rather than an expression of our national pride." They asked for a new jury to be appointed to select a new design. Then Secretary of the Interior James Watt, who oversaw the National Mall, halted the groundbreaking for the memorial's site. Wasn't Maya Lin hurt by all of this?
I actually completely understood why there was such a strong opposition to it. In a way, what they didn't realize was that a lot of the struggle, a lot of the fight was because there was a requirement that all the names be listed. Ironically, that was something the veterans chose. You know, deep down under American memorial art, architecture, it's a little bit of a denial. I don't want to see the dead. I don't want to acknowledge that because it's too painful. I want the parade. I want the happy. I want the exalted. And I think it was a very modern notion in a national capital to list all the names. That's what was very controversial. Okay, it was black. It was below grade. I was female, Asian American, young, too young to have served. Or even the way I would talk, oh, I didn't know much about the war. It's sort of like you have to be that person in order to understand those needs. And I think none of the opposition in that sense hurt me.
It was a psychological memorial, not a formal one, Maya Lin says. And in that sense, there were people who could not imagine the effect it would have until they physically walked through it. But they almost didn't get the chance. Then the negotiations began for a compromise. In many ways, that was the most painful part to Maya Lin. Politicians demanding the stone be white, or that the names appear alphabetically instead of by date of death, or that a flagpole and a 14-foot statue be placed at the apex, towering above the walls, so they'd be nothing more than a backdrop. Maya Lin, all of 21 or 22 at this point, fought like hell to preserve her vision.
To me, I think one could say that entire year was really hard, and I was a very private person, and I didn't want my parents to worry. You know, good Chinese daughter, heaven forbid your parents would worry.
In the end, Lin and the members of the Memorial Fund agreed to the inclusion of a traditional statue by another artist showing 3 life-sized brave soldiers set some distance apart from the wall. At the dedication ceremony, They didn't even mention Maya Lin's name, but she had already left town, so she wasn't there to take in the slight.
And then, a year later, when like the millionth visitor came to it, everybody wanted to like say hello, that sort of thing. And I mean, I was a little jaded. I mean, my attitude is, I'm glad it's a success. I mean, I'm glad people really are moved by it. That was its goal. But you do these things because you personally believe in it. And it was lonely. I mean, it was lonely being in this one testifying room where everyone else was on the other side, looking at me like I was trying to deliberately hurt them. And, you know, it sort of probably jaded me. It's funny, I probably went in there with more sort of an egomaniacal young artist confidence. And I actually became, I think, a little mellower. I mean, it's amazing how when you're young, you're so idealistic. And I was full of, when you're young, maybe that's all you have. You have conviction. And that's valuable. Then you get experience, and then you have less conviction. So I think there's a balance going on.
When you watch people interact with your memorial, what's that like?
Well, it's not my memorial, so that's the thing. It was mine as an idea, and it was mine up until it was built. And this is the beauty of making a work for other people. The minute you give it away, it becomes everybody else's. And at which point you become like everybody else, a visitor to that work, especially when it is about mourning and loss. The very first, I would say the first 5 or 10 years, I mean, I don't know why I knew, but I knew that when people, veterans would come there, they were gonna cry. I don't wanna be a voyeur. It's almost like I wanna respect their time and their space, and they own it much more than me in a lot of ways. If you see what I mean. And so when I build a building or when I do a memorial, these are not for me. They never have been. They're teaching tools. The memorials are about our history. And again, my parents were both educators, and I think they instilled this need to always give back. And that's where, like, you know, I would say 50% of my architecture projects are done for educational or not-for-profit institutions. The memorials absolutely have been done much more because I feel like, you know, we witnessed, or I did growing up, the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement. I mean, the awareness of the Native Americans and what they've been going through. And then for me, of course, very deeply committed to the environment, always have been. So again, how can I, as an artist, use our past, use what's going on in the world, give us a different perspective? And then I don't try to tell you what to think. I've always said, I can present the facts. Now you have to come away with your own conclusions. And that's a big difference. How in all my work I've tried to create these works that put something out there so you can read it, you can understand it, but I am never going to tell you how to conclude that. You know, because I don't have that right to do that. I need to respect you enough to set out the history and then let you come to your own conclusions.
I want to take a turn here to talk about Maya Lin's love of nature and her lifelong commitment to environmentalism, because you can see it in all of her designs, in the memorials and the buildings and the sculptures. She has always wanted to give people a new way of looking at their surroundings. Take, for example, her wave field at the Storm King Arts Center in New Windsor, New York. She changed the contours of 11 acres of their property, creating undulating swells of earth so that it looks like the rolling waves of the ocean covered in grass. The site used to be a gravel pit, so Lin's work is both an act of environmental reclamation and a work of art. But it was also partly inspired by the Native American earth mounds she visited growing up in Ohio.
The environment, from day one. Granted, I was a kid, and I was there watching the news for the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights era, Standing Rock. I remember because Clean Air Act was coming into play, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, Lake Erie catches fire. You know, I grew up in Ohio. All I could think of as a kid was, how does one species have the right to destroy the home of so many other species, let alone cause species to go extinct? I was, from the get-go, my parents would scratch their head because, I mean, we were surrounded by woods, but I was very, very committed. I was petitioning to ban steel traps or to boycott Japan because of the whale hunting.
And she began clipping and collecting newspaper articles about the extinction of species and about biodiversity loss, a practice she continued even when she made the decision to study art and architecture instead of science, a practice that continues to this day. Only now, she says, it's hard to keep up with the volume of news about the destruction of the planet. 25 years ago, Maya Lin says, when she was still in the early phases of her career, she already knew that her final memorial would be about the environment.
Why do you say it's your final memorial? Because you're so young.
Because I'll be donating to it for the rest of my life, because it is a big topic. And I've known that for me, could I cause a memorial that could go wherever it wanted to go? It's free as long as you share it. The nexus of the project is the website, whatismissing.org. We are collecting memories. You know, go online, upload a memory, something you've witnessed either diminish from the natural world or come back. But then the whole upper right is what you can do in your everyday lives to help make a difference.
The welcome text on whatismissing.org says it's a global memorial to the planet, the species that have gone extinct, the species that we will never know because we destroyed their habitats. Click on one of the colorful dots on the map of the world and you can hear audio or see a video or read a story. Maya Lin told journalist Mary Jordan that What is Missing occupies about 50% of her artistic headspace these days.
In a New Yorker profile, they said that you're not a zen-like person,
right.
You're a warrior.
I'm energy incarnate. I don't stop moving, and I don't stop thinking about all the possible ideas. I'm hyper, and I am a warrior. My mother and father were warriors. My brother and I are warriors. I think it's in our psyche, and I'll worry about anything. And if I don't, and my husband would say, if I don't have anything to worry about, then I'll worry about not worrying. I don't know. It's just in my nature.
Does it inform your work?
I think the work is an absolute response to that, because the work ends up being completely calm. And the irony is, I kind of, like, in a public world, I've always been that. I'm pretty removed. In fact, to do the memorials, I've had to stay very removed emotionally. I think what is missing, I'm not so emotionally removed, and it's probably not good for the work because I'm so vested in it, right? It's almost better to keep a distance. But in my creative process, I am kind of exploring, and it is very, it's full of energy, shall we say.
You were about to say, and the funny thing is about this worrying, your husband was saying.
It's part of my psyche. It's something I do. I think as I've grown older, I mean, I would always kind of argue that had I been older, I could never have gotten through Washington. That what got me through Washington was youth. And when you're young, you know, you're right, and all those old people are wrong. And it kind of protects you. When we're young, we're almost invincible. And there is something to be said about youth and having that incredible energy. There's a funny cartoon book. It's called Think Like a Child. So I think as an artist, you never want to grow up. You want to keep that pure, almost innocent way of creating things. And that is really important. That you have to, when you're making something, there's this absolute, it's hard, but then there's this pure joy. And that is kind of the creative adrenaline that fuels, at least it fuels me. Like, I get so excited just in my studio, just coming up with new ideas. It's like you're a kid in a candy store.
Is there any tricks for people who are older to get that stuff out of their head so that they can think like a child?
It's never too late to just start making things. And no one should be intimidated. Oh, I can't draw a straight line. No one should be intimidated. Think of it as a voice. Like, you might not be a great singer, but sometimes we all hum. I mean, doodling should be the same way. Making things should be the same way. It's a language. And to deprive yourself of that language, I think it shuts down a part of who we are as a species.
And you don't need to find a reason for everything you make. Art is, in the end, part magic, Maya Lin says, and we should leave it that way. You can find out more about Maya Lin and her work at achievement.org. She was interviewed for the Academy of Achievement by documentary filmmaker Irv Drasnin and The Washington Post's Mary Jordan. Please take a moment to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you find great podcasts and spread the love. Our hashtag is What It Takes Now. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Thanks to the Katherine B. Reynolds Foundation for their generous funding, and thanks to you for listening.